Writing under the pseudonym A.B. Jewell, journalist Matt Richtel's novel, The Man Who Wouldn't Die, is a satirical take on hard-boiled crime fiction and Silicon Valley. Set in the near future, The Man Who Wouldn't Die takes the culture of Silicon Valley and twists it to the point of absurdity with a deft comic touch. Matt Richtel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who has published 11 books. Matt Richtel, welcome back to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And of course, you're actually, we'll be talking about a book written under a pseudonym, A.B. Jewell. So those of you listening, look for the novel by A.B. Jewell, The Man Who Wouldn't Die. And I have to say, I have to ask you this question, and I think I know the answer. Writing this novel, this send-up of Silicon Valley, must have been actually a lot of fun for you.
Oh, so much. You know, I've been, this is a detective send-up, detective noir story that's a send-up of Silicon Valley, and I've been treating Silicon Valley seriously far too long. It was time for a little laughter. I kept calling my wife in the room saying, is this as funny as I think it is? Sometimes she'd say yes, sometimes she'd say rewrite.
So you've written several mystery novels, very serious books. You're a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter on technology, living there in Silicon Valley yourself. So what drove you to actually write what I would call this absurd satire send-up, taking Silicon Valley to the social media extreme with your protagonist, Fitch, William Fitzgerald, actually sensing and believing like we would as readers, you know, he's sort of our eyes in the book, that they're going to extremes.
Yeah. So can I, just because this is a book-centric show, can I go into the weeds a little bit on just a writing piece of this to answer that question? And then I'll...
Sure.
Meaning the question asks, like, almost philosophically, why take this on? But I'd like to answer for your audience, because I think if we were having a conversation, at least I bet it would go this direction. Why let this voice loose? After all, I've written, I don't know, 10 books, most of them very serious, some nonfiction, extremely serious life and death stories. But here's the real, real truth, Hopeton. I like to laugh, and I think people who know me say, you know, you're a silly guy at times. And my writing philosophy is you should let your voice go. So underneath all the philosophical stuff is just, I wanted to tell some jokes. So that is partly where it came from. More philosophically, where it came from is Silicon Valley's insane, Hopeton. Shall I elaborate on that?
Actually, I actually have a couple of questions I want to ask you that goes into this Silicon Valley being insane, and these are reference points all from this novel. So the first question I have for you, Mr. A.B. Jewell, the author of The Man Who Wouldn't Die, the pseudonym of Matt Richtel, is, do you believe in the digital afterlife?
Well, here's what I do know. I a couple years after my my grandmother died, I got a Facebook invite from her.
You got to be kidding me.
I said, now, hang on a second. I'm pretty sure I was at her funeral. So, and delivered the eulogy. So I guess I absolutely 100% do not believe in the digital afterlife. I absolutely 100% believe that some people are trying to mimic the human spirit and soul such that we might be able to be kept alive in the hereafter. And in our book, Fitch, our one sane guy, our detective, the one sane guy left in Silicon Valley.
All right, let me stop you there real quick, because I want to set up the interest, because the interest is kind of similar to the Maltese Faction. So the book opens. The femme fatale comes in. Of course, her feminine charms ultimately are not going to work on Fitch, because he looks at life a different way. And her father, a giant in the industry, Captain Don.
Yes, Captain Don.
Tweeping to her after he has already died, and she goes in to say, hey, I believe my father was murdered. I need you to find the answer to this. So, but go ahead.
Well, and he says, you've set it up beautifully. And he says, what do you mean your father was murdered? She says, well, he's tweeping from the afterlife. I was murdered. And Fitch, you know, look, here's Fitch. He is a hard-boiled detective in the Raymond Chandler, Jim Thompson, you know, Dashiell Hammett vein. He just wants to get a good cup of coffee and make his way through the day. And by the way, it's hard as heck to get a good cup of coffee in Silicon Valley anymore, because the most simple cup of coffee you can get right now is a latte with echinacea and Red Bull. So he's already behind when his day starts. And she comes in and says, my father is tweeting from the afterlife. He's been murdered. I mean, he says to himself, there's no amount of money in the world that would cause me to take this case. But of course, in Silicon Valley, there's all the money in the world. And at some point, no hard-boiled detective can turn down cold, hard cash.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guess is, and this is a pseudonym, but this is how you'll find the novel, A.B. Jewell, whose real name is actually Matt Richtel, but he's writing as A.B. Jewell, author of The Man Who Wouldn't Die. There are a lot of one-liners in this novel, a lot of really good one-liners. And one of the things that makes the humor work so well is Fitch watching these absurd things, this social media going to the extreme, and he gets it. And so he serves, I guess, as the avatar for the reading audience. He gets the absurdity of the way things are with the super rich in Silicon Valley.
He describes the femme fatale as a TELF, a tech executive I'd like to fund. That is how she describes herself. And she very straight-faced says to him, look, you know, I'm a very charitable person. I have started a foundation that goes around the country helping poor children who are not maximizing their efficiency. She has no idea that the lingua franca of Silicon Valley sounds absurd. And he is a throwback to the old detectives. And so almost everything everybody says to him sounds as it might to the reader, utterly absurd. And I'll give you a kind of example where I've tried to marry the old school hard-boiled detective with Silicon Valley. You know, in the old days, the detective would invariably get into a high-speed car chase, along the highway in the rickety car, 38 specials waving. Well, here, because the commute traffic's so bad, the best he can do is a low-speed car chase where he's being chased by bad guys, and this is really crucial here, Hopeton. The bad guys all drive Mini Coopers, and you know why, but I'll just tell the reader. It turns out in Silicon Valley, if you're a bad guy, a premium isn't put on the speed of your car or how cool it is. It's put on, is it small enough to parallel park? So these are the kinds of sort of clash between the clear-eyed, hard-boiled detective and the madness of the place.
And the tarantulas who are selling this synthetic Adderall, and the problem in school right now in the novel,
yes,
is that the students taking this drug are hyper-attentive and making grades that are too high.
The old school drug gangs, of course, you know, it was meth you can't joke about it at all, but fentanyl or, you know, cocaine or whatever. But these guys have tapped into a real demand market. Students taking the SAT and ACT, and they apparently now have figured out how to create. They say to the the cops say they've created double synthetic Adderall. And Fitch says, isn't Adderall already synthetic? And they say, yeah, but it's got echinacea in it, so you get immune-boosting properties while also being able to focus so much that you can ace the SAT. But here's the problem, Hopeton. Now everybody's acing the SATs, and there appears to be some evidence that the computer test-taking companies may be behind this, because if everybody's acing the SATs, there's going to have to be a new set of tests introduced at government cost.
Which means, of course, they'll make a lot more
money. Make a lot more
money. Planned obsolescence.
Planned obsolescence. This is merely a subplot, I should note. This is not about the afterlife. This is about the here and now and college.
And Captain Don is the father of the client of Fitz. And I like this line that she says when she walks into his office. Her name is Tess.
Yes.
And she says, look, I know what you think when you look at me. Socialite, the kind of woman who gets what she wants, strong and beautiful. So unaware of this arrogance of success.
I think one of the things I've noticed about Silicon Valley, and just a quick pause, I really like a lot about the place. It is truly manifest destiny in the sense that a lot of people are coming, gambling big, coming up with a lot of great stuff, but not nearly as great as they often tell us. I once wrote a column for the New York Times about the number of press releases in a given week or month that use the word revolutionary out of Silicon Valley. And I got to tell you, Tinder for dogs is not revolutionary. So
Wait. This is not from the novel. This is real.
Well,
Tinder for dogs, a dating app for dogs.
But the idea that there were hundreds of press releases, Hopeton, in the first .com revolution over a short period of time that used the word revolutionary, it was like, you know, ice cream to your door in minutes, revolutionary. You know, maybe you could use the adjective neat, or maybe you could use the description munchies, but I don't think you can call that revolutionary. So there's this idea, there's this phrase that goes through Silicon Valley far too regularly used, which is, we're going to change the world. And more as often as not, it comes across as, I'm going to change my net worth.
Wow. Well, look, Captain Don is another same voice from the grave.
Yes.
In the novel. And he recognizes the extremes that Silicon Valley has become. And he coins a term. What is he talks about? Instead of innovation, incrovation?
Yes.
Incremental,
yes.
Incremental innovation?
I can't remember the word. Incremental innovation or something. And he says that basically things keep getting, essentially renamed or digitized forms of what we already have. And just to wax serious for a second, I went after I did this book, and I don't make this point in the book, but if you look at, like, you know, the most popular websites, they are versions of what we have already done, and I believe that 6, 7, and 8 of the most watched websites are pornography. I mean, you know, we're talking Garden of Eden stuff here. We're not exactly talking, the year 2200 on the moon.
Oh, wow. So look, there is a chase scene.
Yes.
With social media involved, and Fitch has to persuade someone to let him use their bike.
Yes.
They only agree if the person says, I agree, if I can ride on the back, and he gets 25% of the social media rights if this chase makes the news.
Yes. So we have become so conditioned in Silicon Valley that something just might make money, that we're all looking for the equity play. You know, I have joked that my son is a he's 10. He's a pretty coming up on 11, a pretty good baseball player. Anybody want 5% of his eventual professional rights? We'll trade it for a pair of cleats right now. So I'd forgotten about that. I mean, I do want to say, Hopeton, it's a good spot to point out, this book is meant to be just a lot of fun. And I took the opportunity to infuse each, for better or worse, I mean, you be the guy, you'll be the judge, Hopeton. I'm curious what you thought, but I tried to infuse these moments of the way to make it satirical was to infuse moments like a car scene or a motorcycle chase scene to negotiate for equity as kind of the extreme version of what happens every day. I don't know. Did that resonate for you?
Well, it resonates because I'm thinking it may not be as absurd as it seems to us who don't live in Silicon Valley. You live in Silicon Valley, and I am assuming in the novel things are a lot closer to reality than we think it is. Even though I'm in Austin, which sort of bills itself as, you know, maybe the Texas Silicon Valley, the Southwest Silicon Valley. But I'm looking at these things, and I'm saying, like the app that rings just to let you know that your ringer is still working, just in case you're panicked that you're not having anyone call.
And do you remember who's behind that, Hopeton?
No, I don't. Tell me.
It's Bono.
Yes,
there was a point
Bono.
Where,
more than one reference to Bono in this novel, by the way. I have to think that you're a U2 fan.
Well, a few years ago, Bono arranged the U2 arranged with Apple to put its album for free on everybody's new iPhone or something like this. And at first people found it novel, and then they realized they were basically being force-fed Bono. And in this book, Bono keeps sending people a ringtone that lets them know that their ringer is still working. It's just an absurd proposition, but again, it is not at all absurd that stuff keeps getting put on your phone. I know everybody knows this feeling. They're like, where did that app come from? Why does it keep showing up all the time? I did not put this here. I don't know what it's doing. And I mean, if you can't make fun of Bono, well, really, then.
Well, look, we have, there's no Alexa or Siri in the book, but there is Shirley with an I.
Yes.
Tell us about Shirley, this critical character in the book that represents.
Well, Shirley turns out to be there's a cocktail party that is it's at a company that has a very, very important purpose, Hopeton. This company helps other companies name their conference rooms on the theory that if your conference room isn't named in sophisticated enough fashion, you can't be productive working there. And Shirley at the conference room naming company is turns out to be the voice and person behind Siri. I mean, we make that supposition, and she can't understand anything anybody says. She keeps misinterpreting them. When I was, just to show how close to home this is, first of all, I think anybody who's had a conversation with Siri knows that it's like a bad marriage. Nobody's really listening or can, even when they try to listen, can't really understand the other person. But on a serious note, so I made a lot of my bones with the New York Times writing about distracted driving, won a Pulitzer writing about it. And a lot of people would say, well, if I interact with my phone, if I leave my hands on the wheel and I use voice activation, am I any safer? And this is Hopeton, what I'm telling you is 100% serious. And the researchers went out and they looked at what was happening when people interacted with a voice activation device. It was both like Siri, and I think they actually used Siri at the time. And do you want to know why it was so distracting to do it?
Why?
Because Siri couldn't understand what someone was saying, and people found themselves bickering with their voice automation device. So you would say, like, I want to go to McDonald's, and it would say, I understand you want to go to Walmart. So then you'd rear-end somebody. I mean, I'm making that part up, but because you were getting distracted. So this surely is based on the very well-meaning, she's very sweet, but she can't understand a darn word anybody says.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is A.B. Jewell, and that is a pseudonym for Matt Richtel. And the name of the book is The Man Who Wouldn't Die. It's a satirical, hard-boiled novel slightly into the social media future. So there was a protest at one time in the book, and real estate agents are protesting, and I like the way you sort of take this history of protests in Silicon Valley. We think about the free speech movement,
yes,
and other things, and you sort of marry this with, the, of course, the real estate boom, or the real estate agents now complaining. And so there, I think their signs say, make down payments, not war.
So they're very frustrated because there's not enough inventory, and there's not enough multi-million dollar inventory, and of course they have Lexus payments to make, so it's a difficult time. I've got to put this in a little perspective here. I am aware, extremely aware, that we are in a that the economics for the world are in a very, very difficult place. Make no mistake, there are many people hurting. But a lot of people in Silicon Valley are not hurting, and you frequently hear them say, to their credit, we've got high-class problems. But I think it can be lost on people in Silicon Valley who complain about things that they are living in a bubble beyond a bubble beyond a bubble. And they are more than putting food on the table. I'll have conversations with people who have sold companies for tens of millions of dollars, mourning that they don't know what to do with their time and what should they do next. And I get that those are very human complaints. But on another level, it's just completely absurd because, of course, you know, go to other places in the country or the world and people are trying to put food on the table, not necessarily organic food, you know, that's been grass-fed.
So let's get to the heart of the story, the moral of the story for me, and it comes directly from the mouth of Captain Don, of course, to an extreme, speaking from the grave, from the spirit box, and he says that basically innovation is an abomination. And we know we're taking that to the extreme, but I think you've sort of touched on this earlier, which is all that innovation claims to be is not necessarily so, and this drive for efficiency and innovation and everyone being measured up to the way the world is viewed from Silicon Valley is something that we really need to take a serious look at.
What I've observed very broadly is that in so many ways we have met the goals, the Platonic ideals that we set out for ourselves as a country. We have access to education. We are dealing with and confronting some of the racism and misogyny and bigotry against people with different sexual preferences. We are we have a social net that helps a lot of people. But, Hopeton, here's the but. There is so much anguish going around. And I think what Captain Don is saying is something's not adding up. And I think this is what I'm saying. We are achieving a lot of things, and we are left on some level existentially or spiritually bereft. What is wrong? And this isn't a book that attempts to make that point, you know, acutely or directly, but that is the underlying point that he's making. All this progress, but where are we? Have we made progress as human beings? I'm not saying we haven't, but there's some anguish, some greed, some low-level hope that we will get more and more and more, but to what end?
I would say that people, depending on what way you're viewing the world from, for those who have made it, they say we've done pretty good, but there's a lot more to do. Yep. And for those who haven't made it, they would say this world is not really that fair. We're sort of this invisible underclass that are conveniently looked over. And I think the, you know, the struggle in and of itself continues. And so one of the challenges, you're a parent, I'm a parent, that I think we all face, those of us who've had some, and I'm going to put this in quotation marks, some level of success, is how do we make sure that our children, and getting very seriously, how do we make sure our children don't look at the life that they have and assume anybody else should be able to make, and if they're not living the same type of lifestyle or have the same type of educational or school success, that it's their fault. And that's something I don't want my child to ever think.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, another way to put that, which I just can't agree with any more than I agree 100, and I don't, I'm not good with math. 112%, is that the maximum? see, I don't have much of a stock portfolio, so I can't tell if it's going up or down. But the if I could put that in, wrap that in another way, is I think we need to understand our blessings and recognize that they are such, and that some of us got born into the right circumstances, or we had parents who helped us in certain ways, or schools that helped us in certain ways. And I think the idea, I think there's something part about Silicon Valley that is a lot about furthering ourselves without really seeing that big picture. And it comes under the guise of people saying we're changing the world, and a lot of people are really amazing people out there, don't get me wrong. But the things you allude to, hoped in there, there's some real changing of the world that needs to happen still for a lot of other people. And at the same time, a lot of complaining and ennui and anguish among people who have it really, really good. And I think we need to recognize how, in a way, spoiled we are.
And to, wow, this got real serious, Matt.
Well, like, here's the thing. I love this conversation, Hopeton, and I hope, you know, this book is meant to be fun, but I don't think real comedy happens without a serious underpinning to it. But I've done all that serious stuff, or I don't want to even point to me. That's not the right way to put it. That serious stuff has been done a lot, and I've spent my life trying journalistically and as an author to get at those real issues. And at some point, I just needed to laugh a little bit, and I wanted to have the reader laugh along with me. But it's not done, you know. It's not cheap pun jokes. It's jokes that are built on a philosophical look at a place that plays a key role in our society, and then hopefully built around a really just fun detective novel so that you're swept up in the plot. That's my job. My job, first of all, is to entertain you. After that, if it's got some meaning behind it, well, it's a bonus.
And that would be The Man Who Wouldn't Die, a novel by A.B. Jewell, which is the pseudonym of Matt Richtel. I really enjoyed the novel, Matt.
This is a great conversation, Hope, and I'm glad we had it.